Isaiah. Maybe if there's just like one thing every week you like go home with it, the burden for you to read the book. And I don't just like mean, well, I read it. I mean like read it again and again and understand it. Because, well, like I said, I think I could be on a desert island and only have Isaiah and never be spiritually hungry. It's that rich. And today, we're looking at one chapter, and we're going to be thrashing around a little bit and trying to figure it out. It's a tough passage, chapter 7. It's a controversial passage. But it's only one chapter of the book. There's a story here. And I can only do so much in a half hour or 35 minutes. So we've been taking Isaiah chapter at a time. So it's been 7 weeks. So today's chapter 7. And it is controversial, but I'm not teaching it for that reason. I'm teaching it because Isaiah revealed it, and it's important, and it fits into the whole. In fact, you can't, in my opinion, understand chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11, 12 if you get chapter 7 wrong. I mean, it all ties together, which also means, too, you know, after we're done today, that I don't know that you're going to have the full picture. You're not. Hopefully we're going to resolve one matter, or one, you know, one passage, and then we can build on that next week and every week thereafter. So you can turn to chapter 7 while I tell you what's happened in chapters 1 through 6. Let me just remind you, Isaiah prophet around 700 BC, now he's about 740, 735 right now, prophet to Judah, the southern kingdom. He's not saying happy things. Mostly, the people are wicked. They've a lot of them have been blessed by God, but they haven't acted righteously. They've perverted the grace of God to oppress their neighbors, and so Isaiah is just telling him, "You're guilty, and you're going to be judged." That's the main message of chapters 1 through 5. There's some glimmers of hope because, I mean, God can never, it seems like, you know, the whole Bible, he can never say judgment without also saying, but that's not the whole story, because I made promises and I'm going to keep them. So your greatest sin can't negate my promise. It will. So there's these glimmers of hope that peek out a few verses at a time, the beginning of chapter 2, beginning of chapter 4. But it's basically, you're guilty and you're going to be judged. And then chapter 6, last week, of course, Isaiah comes into the throne room. He sees the Lord, high and lifted up. And the Lord says, who will go for us? And Isaiah volunteers. And what's the mission? What's the charge? You're going to go and speak to deaf people. They're blind. Whatever you say, they're not going to accept. And they're going to go into exile. It's like, if the land is like a forest, I'm going to chop all the trees down. But there's a stump from which will sprout the holy seed. That glimmer of hope popping up again. It's very important. I'm not reviewing because I don't have enough to say. I've just laid a very critical. Everything I just said now is what all the guys who disagree with me ignore. They all ignore everything I just said. And they ignore chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. Now, it's a little bit strong, and I don't want to be too strong against guys who I love. There are some of the guys who I disagree with I love. Some of them I don't. But I have not said that. You know, there are those different ways of meaning love. Like, maybe I love them, like,
Did
you? Yes, I'm turning away. So it's very important. The people are, their ears are closed and their eyes are shut and they're not listening. They're not willing to trust God. He's going to judge them. So let's see what happens in chapter 7. If you have it open, then you can read it. I will pass out handouts here in a sec. I didn't print out the text on the handout today because it's a long passage and I had other things to write on the handout. So we'll just read it. How should we break this down? You know, we'll break it down on my outline. This isn't even or fair if you were my kids in terms of, because it's like two verses and who would read the first two verses?
I do two.
Okay, Grady. And then verses 3 through 11 is the next, in my opinion, section or unit. Brad, if you'll take 3 through 11 and then 12. Just verse 12. Kelly, okay. And then the last big section is verses 13 through 25. We'll take that. Okay, Jeff. Go ahead.
Now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, the king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Ramaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. When it was reported to the house of David, saying, Syria has camped in Ephraim, his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind.
Yes.
Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet King Ahaz, you and your son Shephatiah. You will find the king at the end of the aqueduct that feeds water into the upper pool near the road leading to the field where cloth is bleached. But tell him to stop worrying. Tell him he doesn't need to fear the fierce anger of those two burned out embers, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah the son of Remaliah. Yes, the kings of Amram and Israel are coming against you. They are saying, we will invade Judah and throw its people into panic. Then we will fight our way into Jerusalem and install the son of Tabeel as Judah's king. But this is what the Sovereign Lord says. This invasion will never happen because Aram is no stronger than its capital, Damascus. And Damascus is no stronger than its king, Rezin. As for Israel, within 65 years it will be crushed and completely destroyed. Israel is no stronger than its capital, Samaria, and Samaria is no stronger than its king, Pekah, son of Remaliah. You do not believe me? If you want me to protect you, learn to believe what I say. Not long after this, the Lord sent this message to King Ahaz. Ask me for a sign, Ahaz, to prove that I will crush your enemies as I have promised. Ask for anything that you like, and make it as difficult as you want.
But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test.
Then Isaiah said, hear now, house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of two kings you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring on you and your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. In that day, the Lord will whistle for flies from the distant streams of Egypt and for bees from the land of Assyria. They will all come and settle in the deep ravines and in the crevices and in the rocks and all thorn bushes and at all the water holes. In that day, the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the king of Assyria, to shave your head and the hair of your legs and take off your beards also. In that day, a man will keep alive a young cow and two goats. And because of the abundance of milk they give, he will have curds to eat. All who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. In that day, in every place that there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 silver shekels, there will only be briars and thorns. Men will go there with bow and arrow, for the land will be covered with briars and thorns. As for all the hills once cultivated by the hoe, you will no longer go there for fear of the briars and thorns. They will become places where cattle are turned loose and where sheep run. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things in this chapter that are not hard. There are a few things that are difficult. And the goal here is to understand it, to work through the text. We want to understand what Isaiah was saying, what God, the divine author, is trying to reveal here. This isn't necessarily a passage. You know this class well enough that we don't always have like, well, how am I going to, what am I going to do tomorrow differently? But to understand the purposes of God and understand his mind and how he works, and then I don't have this maybe worked through this enough to express it real clearly, but when I think about Isaiah and the things that, like the light that's in my heart, as I, for about a year now I've been just working through Isaiah, I think glory. Mm-hmm. And I'm appreciating the glory of God. So, you got to do that by a piece at a time, in a way. And sometimes you wrestle with this piece, you gnaw on this piece, and then you know that you get a breakthrough, and then you can go beyond that. So, let's just go by the outline. The front page of your handout there is the way I outline the book. And again, like I say, nothing magical, but I just sort of trace pretty much the narrative development of this passage. And we'll start with the first section here. It's pretty simple. If you get hung up on names, then it's not. If you're trying to keep track, like who is Rezin again and who is Pekah, and, you know, you don't have to remember that to really understand the passage. I put a few things down in your notes if you want to. But the bottom line is that Judah is threatened. Judah is being attacked. You say, Judah's being attacked by Israel, the northern kingdom? Yes. They didn't always get along. The northern kingdom allied with another nation, Damascus, the country of Aram. Those two guys, they want Judah to join their alliance so they can fight against Assyria. You don't have to remember all this. But if you're ready for it. And Judah's saying, no, we're going to ally ourselves with Assyria. Right, they're basically choosing sides. So Israel and Aram say, no, we're not going to let that happen. Judah, we're going to squash you. And more specifically, we're going to see here the threat is not just against Judah, but it's against Judah's king. That's not irrelevant to what's going on here. They want to take Judah's king off the throne. How many dynasties have ruled over Judah since David? One. In the northern kingdom, it's like the king and his son, and then they massacre the whole family. The king and his son, they massacre the whole family. If you get lucky, you get your grandson, great-grandson on, and then it all wipes. But in Judah, it's just an unbelievable thing. It's always... Now, you know what? Sometimes the king gets killed. He gets assassinated by his counselors. That happens. But what happens next? Always his son. There's something going on here. I mean, maybe it's God, maybe who promised that he would preserve the line. But now there's a major threat. And Ahaz, it says, he is trembling like the trees of the forest are shaken. He is very, very afraid. You'll never read this about Obama in the papers. You know, he'll always act, or Bush. Bush, I mean, they always act like they got it together. Ahaz knows he's in real big trouble. So then the next section, verses 3 through 11 here, Isaiah the prophet comes to Ahaz, and he says, you need to trust God. You need to believe God has promised that he would preserve the Davidic line, and he's going to stick to that promise. He doesn't say it in those words here, but that's in the background. Everybody, they all know this. They all know that, yeah, we've had the same Davidic house for 200 years, and now it's in jeopardy. So, Isaiah says, don't worry. God's got it under control. These two kings, they seem like they are the, the dominant powers. They're really smoldering stubs of firewood. The flame's almost out. The flame is out, and they're just going to be ashes in the morning. Don't worry about them. And there's a few verses here. He goes on about it a little bit. He gives a little poem here in verses 7 and 8 and 9. Just to say, it's taken care of. God is going to get rid of your enemies. Believe him. That's very important here. In verse 9 is the call to Ahaz. This is going to happen. Now trust him. Trust God to do this. And now, does this just mean like a feeling in your heart? It might mean it if you're like Little Joe Private Farmer. But if you're the king, if you're going to trust God, you're going to act a certain way. Like not making an alliance with another nation to save you. Is Ahaz going to trust God or the Assyrians? This is the question that Ahaz has before him. And so, the Lord says, verse 10, and by the way, it goes back and forth here between the Lord and Isaiah. Like, when the Lord's, like suddenly now, like there's a voice from the sky and Isaiah's looking on. No, right? It's the Lord speaking through Isaiah. So when Isaiah's speaking, the Lord's speaking. And when the Lord's speaking, it's through Isaiah. Ask the Lord for a sign. Whether it's the deepest depths or the high, just anything in the world. I mean, you could probably come up with some fun little things that he could have, asked for, right? And he says, this is the next, what I put in the next section here. I wanted to draw attention to this. Ahaz says, no. No God. And he tries to put some little religious sugar coating on it, like, oh well, it's not right to ask God, not right to test God. Well, you're not testing God when He asks you. Ahaz, and I put it in here too, just so it's really clear here. I mean, Ahaz, it's not like he's a really righteous guy, and it's very clear here how you understand this. He is. As wrong as could be. He doesn't want to trust God. Yes, Sandy?
Well, I was going to say, so what he's doing is refusing to allow God to show himself and to give God credit.
That's right. Yes.
The other thought I have is that a lot of times things that sound spiritual really aren't necessarily godly. That happens a lot.
Yes, Greg.
Well, I just was reading your notes here. You're talking about he sacrificed his sons. So, yeah, I mean, he's willing to sacrifice his sons to the other gods. But when it comes to God, oh, well, I won't test him because, why? I mean, this guy's a little whack.
A little bit.
Yes. He's also, this may sound familiar, those of you with modern politics. He reflects the people. Even though he wasn't elected. And you don't... I'm not speculating, right? That's what it says, not only in chapters 1 through 6, but the rest of the book, too. I mean, the heart of the people was not to trust the Lord. Ahaz would rather trust Assyria than God. He may have already made plans to trust Assyria. There's some... You can look at... If you want the more background on the story, you can look in the first... King, or 2 Kings 16 and 2 Chronicles 28. But I think the key for us understanding here is to see Ahaz's rejection. And by the way, too, is this like a surprise to Isaiah? Like, oh, no. I would never have guessed. No, chapter 6, God says, I'm going to send you, and their ears are going to be So this is example A. The king, the next day, after chapter 6. And then here's another thing too. And this is a very important concept. I don't know that I can explain it properly. Well, I'll read. I didn't make this point last week, but does it sound familiar? Be ever hearing but never understanding. Be ever seeing but never perceiving. Like, why is it familiar?
Jesus quoted it.
Okay. In the did anybody know the context of when he quoted it?
They were asking him for a sign.
Then maybe that's another occasion. I know there's one occasion where he quotes it, where they say, "Why are you talking in parables?" Mm-hmm. Matthew 13. Mm-hmm. If a preacher ever says, "The reason I tell lots of stories is because Jesus told lots of stories," they're like, "Hold on a second here. The reason why Jesus told parables was to divide between his listeners, so that those who had ears to hear would understand the spiritual truth, and those who didn't have it would hear a nice little story and not get it." That's what Isaiah is doing here. I think, and I haven't read this anywhere, so be suspicious. I think one of the reasons why this is a tough passage to understand, why there's some in-house division over the virgin birth prophecy, is because, if you take this the wrong way, I didn't mean it that way, but I think it's intentionally enigmatic. I think there's intentionally, like, Ahaz could hear it and think one thing, and Matthew could read it and think something else. It only meant one thing. I think that Ahaz just would have missed it. And if you didn't understand that, that's okay. But I'm wrestling with this idea that I think that there is some mystery here. There's a seed thought in chapter 7, which Isaiah is going to expand upon in chapters 9 and 11. And that's where we are right now. The last section of our outline here, Isaiah responds with a prophecy. Misspelled, I apologize. Misspelling. Of exile, that should be a prophecy with a C. But here it says, Isaiah says, "Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also?" Do you think he's happy? No. Do you think he's just going to say, "Okay, Ahaz, I offer to give you a sign. You refuse. Well, I think I'll just continue on as if you had... said the right thing." I think I would have done this thing. No, you reject it. I'm going to respond this way. So I think that's an important point in this interpretation. So then here's the passage. Here's the crux, the key verse that is a source of dispute. "Therefore, the Lord Himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel." Let's keep reading. "He will eat curds and honey." Who's the he? It's Emmanuel. "He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria." I wrestled with this passage for quite a while, a year ago when I was working on it. And so now I've got to try to get you to understand what it took me a month or whatever to figure out in about 5 minutes. So simply, hopefully, I'm going to try to make it simple. 14 through 17 must be read together, like I just did. The prophecy is not only, or the sign even, the sign is not only about a virgin giving birth. It's the virgin giving birth in something. The virgin, the child who is born, who's named Emmanuel, He's going to eat curds and honey. What does that mean? That is the diet of poverty. Honey from bees, curds are from goats. That's not like you got a big farm. That the land has been destroyed and you're eking out an existence. And I think there's a most translations I think have this word wrong. He will eat curds and honey when. It doesn't say when. That's interpretive, and they're importing it from the next verse. The next verse has when. This verse doesn't. This verse, I think it should be, he will eat curds and honey that, is literally, it's an infinitive, that he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. In other words, this boy, who I'm going to take to be Jesus, this boy, growing up in poverty, in circumstances of suffering, learns right and wrong. Learns to do what Ahaz can't do. This is an indictment on Ahaz too. It's Ahaz, you don't know how to refuse the wrong and choose the right. This boy is going to learn it from his suffering, which you're bringing about. You're bringing about the suffering, and this boy, and you're not going to see where I get this, and that's okay, but trust me, maybe. This boy, who is your descendant? He's not going to grow up in the palace like you. He's going to grow up, he's going to be eating curds and honey. But he's going to learn from it righteousness. Hebrews 5:8, if you want to jot that in your margin. I think Hebrews 5:8 is picking up on this verse where it says that Jesus learned obedience through what he suffered. Now, let's stay with me here. The toughest part of my view, in my view, you say, like, what do you mean your view? My view is the traditional view of the church through the ages. But it's not the popular view today. There's a lot of good people, some of my teachers and friends who say that this is not a direct prophecy about Jesus. I'm presenting it to you. The traditional view is that it's a direct prophecy about Jesus. And then the toughest part to my view then is verse 16, because it gives a chronological marker here. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, and the short answer is, that's 20 years old. Some people want to make it 2 or 3. It's not. It's 20. Which, that's going to definitely help my view. For reasons that we're kind of cutting up the top of the cake here. There's a whole lot that lies underneath. But so before the boy is 20 years old, but he doesn't just say before the boy is 20 years old, he's got to rub it into Ahaz again. Before the boy knows how to choose the good and reject the evil, like unlike you, Ahaz, then the land will be laid waste. You got to tie verses 16 and 17 go together. The land of these of your enemies is going to be destroyed by, verse 17, Assyria. So, if you're thinking like, is this like hope? Is this like, oh yay, our enemies are destroyed, we get relief by Assyria, verse 18 and through 25 is Assyria, yes, they come and they take out the two kings, boom, boom, and they keep coming. And Judah, and then, so all of verses 18 through 25 is describing exile conditions. The land is deserted because the people of Judah have been thrown out of it. Is this good? I think, if I was like standing there and understanding it the way that I believe it should be understood, I think, you know, there would be, in verses 15 and 16, you'd be like, oh, good, good, and then, oh. It's like a fake, you know, like it seems like it's going to be deliverance, but it's not. Which is what Isaiah's been saying the whole time, right? You don't deserve deliverance. You deserve judgment. You deserve what I promised, guilty people. to be taken out of the land. So where does this boy fit in here? The boy is born into that. He eats the curds and the honey because he's born in the exile. He's born in another country. I mean by that, when Jesus was born, he said, "Oh, they're back from the exile." Well, kind of. They're kind of back. Are they back spiritually? Are they back politically? Do they have like sovereignty? Do they have any of the? They're under Roman oppression. So the exile didn't end. It ended in, you know, maybe spatially. So, here's the timeline that Isaiah is predicting. The two kings are going to be destroyed by Assyria, who's also going to destroy you. And then out of that, the virgin will conceive. You don't have to agree with that. Of course, you don't have to agree with that. Anything I say.
But you won't love it.
God, it's a little the tough thing here is, and I'm not giving you the other side for sake of time, not because I'm trying to be unfair, but the tough thing they would say is that this seems to be talking about an immediate birth of a boy. And you know what? I'm willing to concede that. What's the one thing the prophets don't know? Time. That's the thing. That's what it says in Peter 1:19. Right? So 2 Peter 1:19. 1 Peter 1:19. So I think this passage should be understood like the rest of Isaiah's prophecies, which is exile coming, but hope rising out of it. A virgin will conceive. Now, we talk about the virgin word here, because this is debated. In the 1950s, Bibles were burned when they translated the RSV, and they changed the traditional translation was virgin, and they made it young woman, and so people were so irate. So if you read a New American Standard today, that's why. Because people said, we're not going to use the RSV, we'll make a conservative version of the New American Standard. And so it's a very highly controversial debate. I'll boil it down to this and say, you know, when you're going across languages, there's not always an exact one-to-one, right? Catherine's nodding her head because of Spanish.
Translating to Indian languages, but there's not always the exact phrase.
Exactly.
Like the world became, God's love of the world became all the people who lived on this head-shaped earth. You had to make all these words.
So there's not a word in Hebrew which has the technical sense that our word virgin does. A woman who's not been with a man. There's not a word. Doesn't exist. There's two words that mean young woman. And the one used here is alma. And it means young woman. That word itself doesn't prove her virginity. But in that culture, what do you assume about a young woman? And one whom God is going to use to give a sign. So I think, even though it's not one-to-one, the best word that captures, you could say young maiden, maybe in our culture, and maybe we would understand by that, we mean an unblemished, pure maiden. Every time that same word, alma, is used in the Old Testament, it's never used of someone who's not a virgin. And furthermore, I'll go with that. Some say that the virgin will be with child doesn't mean that the virgin is pregnant, but that she's a virgin, and then she gets married, and then she gets pregnant. And one of the ways they see that is they go to chapter 8, where Isaiah goes to his wife and has a boy. And they say that's the fulfillment of this passage. The problem with that is Isaiah's wife wasn't a virgin because they already had a kid. Remember Shar Yashub? Well, that's the one who's born then. But they already had, so she wasn't a virgin when, and it says she'll call him Emmanuel, but in chapter 8 they named the boy Maher Shalal Hashbaz, which is not only a different name, it has a totally different meaning. And other reasons why they, in my opinion, they can't be the same. And then to maybe kind of summarize that up to say, I think one of the strongest points for my view is Isaiah predicts, and it's never fulfilled in the passage. There's never, he says it's going to happen, and you think, well, is it going to happen in a few years, or, but he never says here it is. And then the other, and I gave you more notes here than I'm talking about. I gave you the arguments, my arguments against. Just an outline form on this page here. Difficulties. I'm giving you why I don't accept the view that Emmanuel was born a couple years later. But I just wrote down 5 reasons. And one of them, I think, is the fact that it's a virgin. And by the way, you know, the Greek, the Bible is translated into Greek a few hundred years before Jesus. The word they chose to translate the word virgin was a Greek word which specifically didn't mean virgin. Which is like, what were they thinking? I'll tell you what. Well, maybe they were thinking, we're still waiting. He said there's going to be a virgin. There's never been a virgin. Which, by the way, they're still waiting for what's going to happen in chapter 9 and chapter 11. And I don't know that there's any single point here that makes the case for either side, but I think cumulatively, I think the future fulfillment, only direct prophecy speaking about Jesus, is the best view. Yes?
There's maybe a possibility of a partial double fulfillment here. Mm-hmm. Like in Daniel, where he talks about the desolation of the holy place, mm-hmm. which occurred, but it speaks of a more... Is that a possibility here, or not?
Some people hold it.
You don't hold that.
I don't. One of the problems is, and that's my point number one here on difficulties. I say once fulfilled, always fulfilled. Mm-hmm. I believe you have to find it in the text. So if the text doesn't say there's going to be two women who give birth and name their child Emmanuel. To me, if that child was born then, in the 8th century, that prophecy is fulfilled. And you can't just come along later and say, well, it's going to be fulfilled again. I don't see, I think Isaiah would have scratched his head and gone, what are you talking about? I mean, it's fulfilled here. So, some people don't make it a double fulfillment, they'll say it's a type. So, the baby was born there, and then Matthew saw, look, Jesus is like this Emmanuel guy, but he's bigger and better. He is the anti-type of the original Emmanuel. And that's a common view. I don't see textual basis for that. And if Matthew came up with it, if Matthew is the one who said, oh yeah, look at this, when he was writing his gospel, what did Mary think that day when the angel showed up? What did Joseph think? I think that they were able to go back to Isaiah and say, oh yeah, this is what's going on here. It's not a type that Matthew figured out. It's a... But other... people... Those who read this passage and say, no, this has to happen right now, but I'm still a Christian... That's what they do. And I would say it's a resort. That means they might not appreciate that. But that's their way out of...
Well, I see your view as a more conservative view.
Oh, it is.
And I appreciate that.
It's tough, right? And so, I know this class is at a lot of different levels, and some of you have studied this more, and you have objections, and I'd be happy to, if you want, to talk about them. I don't... my burden is not that you agree with me, but at least that you see what's going on here, because, and by the way, the best part of this handout, in my opinion, is the questions to ponder. And I'll just say before I look at that, the summary on the back, I just wrote this like in case you fell asleep or something, or it's just like just to see my interpretation in short form. But the questions to ponder, this is, to me, I win this debate. I, who am I? But, you know, this, the position in which I subscribe just totally wins, not on the basis of verse 14, or even in, you know, chapter 7. But you give me chapter 6, and 8, and 9, and 10, 11, and I think the case is very convincing. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I read last night. A long article written by a very conservative scholar, good guy, great guy, taking the other side. There was no chapters, no Isaiah 6, no Isaiah 8, no Isaiah 9. You can't look at that because it will lead you. This, what Isaiah is doing, I'm ending right now, in chapter 7, but you're coming, but I'm going to keep teaching it next week's chapter 8 and 9, so I'm going to delve there, but I'm giving you a preview. The Emmanuel who's born here is the same child who's born in chapter 9. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and he will be called Mighty God. Does that like ring any bell? Like, oh, God with us? Mm-hmm. He is this thread, and this is Isaiah's style. He does it with all kinds of things. But he gets this thread going throughout, developing it, and it's glorious. I mean, to me, that's what I get out of this, is the grandness of God's plan, the wisdom of his revelation, that he would, to a wicked people, send his son to be God with us, to be, as Isaiah tells us, to how does it go in Isaiah 53? All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us gone to his own way. The Lord has laid upon him the iniquity of us all. This is this grand plan that Isaiah is unfolding. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your wisdom and plan, and maybe it's different, and if I'm wrong, I mean, it's still grand and glorious, of course, and you're infinitely wise, but it seems to me that you gave this little seed prophecy here to not to Ahaz, but to his people as a confirmation that all of your promises would come true, including the one that the descendant of David would sit on the throne forever. And we know, of course, that is Jesus, and we love him, and we love who he is. We love not only what he has done for us, but also what he is going to do in the future as revealed to us in your word. So we thank you. Make us better servants of yours because of this. May we love you more. May we seek you more. May our hunger be stirred. May our thirst for you be stronger now than it was an hour ago, we pray in Jesus' name.
Oh, yeah.
I have an idea because I was actually going to ask that. So maybe if this isn't a case of that, you do see that sometimes, don't you?
Or do you not believe that there were two? Sort of a foreshadowing, like this might actually take place in an